What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Money Maker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before. Because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef. Because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Claire Madeline Culkin. Today, we will be discussing a volume titled Christianity and Psychoanalysis, published in 2014 by InterVarsity Press, with its editors, Drs. Earl Bland and Brad Strawn. Dr. Strawn is a reverend ordained in the Church of the Nazarene, who received his doctorate of philosophy in clinical psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary, where he also holds a Master's of Arts degree in theology. Currently, Dr. Strawn serves as a professor there, where he teaches the integration of psychology and theology in clinical applications. Dr. Earl Bland holds a doctorate of psychology from the Illinois School of Professional Psychology, as well as certificates in psychoanalytic psychotherapy. Currently, he is on the faculty of the Greater Kansas City Psychoanalytic Institute, the Brookhaven Institute for Psychoanalysis and Christian Theology, as well as at the Rosemead School of Psychology at Biola University, where, like Strawn, he teaches on integration from a clinical perspective. In Christianity and Psychoanalysis, Drs. Strawn and Bland call for a new conversation between religion and psychoanalysis, which the authors understand to share a meaningful explanatory space in that both systems are driven toward an understanding of the human condition. They argue that religious beliefs on both sides of the treatment play a role in the meaning-making between clinician and patient, and are therefore of theoretical and clinical importance to a psychoanalytic perspective. Please welcome them to the discussion.
So Earl and Brad, welcome to the New Books Network. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks.
Thank you.
As you know, I've introduced the listeners a little bit to your professional backgrounds as well as to the book. One of the things that I find so unique about your approach to your areas of academic inquiry is the radical personal stance that you guys take in authoring this text. I was wondering if you would be able to speak a little bit of the personal questions that you had that kind of this work came out of.
Yeah, this is Earl. Sure, Claire. I think I'll speak for me, and probably Brad will be able to highlight his own experience. But this project is a culmination of a lot of different aspects of personal and professional trajectories. One is the search to make sense of a fairly significant faith development in my own life, and also engaging a profession that provides an incredible amount of deep meaning and orientation. So having a conversation between one's faith and one's psychology can take one in lots of different directions. But for me in particular, it took me to more of a depth exploration. So just as there was an attempt to understand the deep meanings of faith, there was an attempt to understand the deep aspects of psychology and psychotherapy and certainly clinical practice. I think psychoanalysis, as we try to highlight in the book, is a good match for that. That there are some synergies, not to overuse a word, but that can really bring together one's exploration of the Christian faith and clinical practice from a psychoanalytic bent. That being said, there's also some other issues around just the formation of a community that really had an impetus towards bringing this book together.
Yeah, this is Brad. I would say, I came to faith first and psychoanalysis second. But for a period of time, I think it was difficult to reconcile the two. And as we again outline in the book, with changes in philosophy and psychoanalysis and in theology, things begin to move intellectually to a place where these two could now have a kind of respectful conversation with one another. And I think even on a more personal note, for me was the issue of how does one integrate one's religious faith with psychology in general. And what I think psychoanalysis helped me understand was that that background, one's religious faith, whether it's being part of a particular religious denomination or faith tradition, is not unlike the impact of one's culture or one's gender. And that I think psychoanalysis helps us understand that we really need to understand and clarify that tradition, not in pathological ways, but in a much more understanding way. How does our faith tradition, how does our culture, how does our gender really impact the way we are in the world, the way we are with one another? And again, I think I found that psychoanalysis was very, very helpful in doing that. However, what's interesting when it comes to religion, and maybe we'll talk some more about this, is that many people who integrate their faith with psychology have not kind of clearly articulated their faith, what that particular tradition is about. So they may talk about culture or gender, for example, or even sexual orientation impact, but don't talk about faith, which is, if the surveys are right, then upwards of 90% of the people in the Western United States anyway will say that they come from some sort of faith tradition. So that's a little bit about how those two things got worked around inside of me.
Yeah. So in the introductory chapter, speaking to this a little bit, you guys say the relational turn in theology has matched the relational emphasis found in much of modern psychology and particularly contemporary psychoanalysis. It is questionable, however, whether the literature on the integration of Christianity and psychology has followed this shift to relationality. I think that kind of speaks to one of the more theoretical points that you guys are making in this book or are trying to address by compiling this work. But there's also a way in which there's a more clinical issue, which I think, Brad, you're bringing up now. What interests me in coming to both of your work is that I was introduced to this entire world of psychoanalytic inquiry that I was never aware of. You both have backgrounds at universities that have religious orientation. And Brad, I know that you are currently working in a program that focuses a lot on integration. Is that fair of me to say? Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you both, speaking to your individual experiences, what point of relation you guys found, how you guys came together as thinkers who are going to put this work together, where that disjuncture existed in environments where ostensibly this conversation was already taking place.
I'll go first. You can fill in all the holes I leave. Well, again, for me, what was interesting, I think I guess we should be, again, traditioned and explicit here.
Yeah.
My circle is kind of Judeo-Christian, evangelicalism, actually. And so in that circle, for many years, psychology itself has been suspect. It's been seen to be antithetical to religion. Thankfully, in the last, 100 years or so, well, maybe more than that, there's always been psychologists from religious faith who have been sort of struggling with integrating the two. So that's been going on for quite some time. Some of those early thinkers were analytic in some sense, but, as we outlined in the first chapter, of course, the influence of Freud was not very positive toward religion. So whereas psychology has been suspect in Christian circles, and even Christian academia, I think psychoanalysis even more so. So it was difficult to find in some ways, a community of people who were open to this and wanted to think about it. However, again, historically, there are some people, including Harry Guntrip, Ian Sudi, and Marie Hoffman is a current analytic writer who has documented historically many of the religious and Judeo-Christian influences of early psychoanalytic writers. Earl and I met actually through the Society for the Exploration of Psychoanalytic Therapies and Theology, which is an organization that's sort of based in the East Coast through Marie and Lowell Hoffman, who are graduates of the NYU postdoc program. And we've developed together a society and now even, I think, the first overtly Christian psychoanalytic institute that, again, is based in the Pennsylvania area of just like-minded people, people who had some of them who had Christian faith, some of them who were of kind of related faith traditions, but really or spirituality, but really wanted to think about what do these two have to do together? Because as Earl said, there's such a deep sense of meaning, you know, even in some sense, ontology. Who are we as people? What is our purpose here in the world? So, and those things sort of begin to come together. And as I mentioned, I think that what I found in the integration literature, which is the term we kind of use in my sphere of influence of relating psychology and theology, is that much of that work was very, very general or monolithic. There was the interest to try to create models where, you know, this is how you put psychology and theology in a conversation with one another. And again, it was treating psychology as sort of one thing, and it was treating theology as one thing. And as we know, there's just so many different variations and colors on both ends of that spectrum that we really need to ask the question, well, are we talking about clinical psychology? And now in clinical psychology, what kind of clinical psychology are we talking about? And are we talking about theology? And if we're talking about theology, what branch of theology? And are we talking about theology at the level of abstract propositional beliefs? Are we talking about it at the level of practical theology, what one does in one's life to grow in faith and character? And so, again, I think a big impetus was to try to, as much as possible, kind of keep narrowing this conversation down to where we could kind of take small bites of it in hopes to be more clear, but also in hopes to invite more people into the conversation in whatever particular way they wanted to be part of it.
Right. Yeah. I think at one point in the first chapter, you describe or you just kind of assert this fact that is so obvious. And then yet when you draw it out, it seems like something I've never really thought about before, that psychoanalysis is a moral discourse. And I think you referenced Philip Reif when you make that statement. So what I'm gathering from what you're saying is that in a clinical setting where both the analyst and the analysand, if you want to define the relationship like that, are coming into the equation with really important theological or moralistic beliefs or worldviews, you can't ignore that. And yet, if you want to pay attention to it, you need to do it with like rigorous specificity.
Right, right. Exactly true. And I think, you know, Philip Cushman is another person we reference. Even our very theories, even our psychoanalytic theories have implicit with them these sort of ethical commitments and obligations. And so we're asking psychoanalysts who aren't even of a religious ilk to ask the question, what is the underlying implicit ethic of my theory?
Yeah.
And I think, Brad, don't you think that that's a conversation that very often has been fairly robust within faith circles? So certainly within the discussion in Christian psychology circles, I'm in an integrated program like Brad. And so there's a lot of discussion of the sort of influence of values on one's clinical work. And I think part of the discussion that we had noticed in the literature was that there was a book written about 10 years ago by Randy Sorensen called Minding Spirituality, in which he was speaking towards the psychoanalytic community and saying, hey, listen, we probably need to pay attention to people's faith and religion as we're doing psychoanalysis. I think Brad mentioned mutual recognition by Marie Hoffman, which was another sort of step in that direction. And so part of what we were trying to do with this book as well was to sort of turn the face towards our own community, evangelical community, and say, there are some things that are happening in psychoanalysis that are really in concert with some of the things that we really believe in, such as depth understanding of human persons and the processes of psychoanalysis in terms of understanding the depth of human persons and the value conversation are really congruent with how we understand the world and how we want to do clinical work, and certainly how to it allows us to be much more explicit about who we are as persons in the clinical and intersubjective realm of psychoanalysis.
Brad, you had mentioned a moment ago that in your experience, there were these sort of, the specific word that you used, there were these sort of like models or something for how to discuss these two things together. Did you experience that as well?
Yeah, I think part of the history of this conversation has been going on, I think now for about, explicitly, Brad, probably about 60 years. Mm-hmm. Since clinical psychology really took off, is that people from Christian faith and from other traditions as well, there's certainly explorations of this in Jewish psychology and Islamic psychology, but I think Christianity from an evangelical realm has been trying to bring those together. And there's a whole intellectual reason for the disjuncture. But first of all, the conversation started out, can these two worlds talk to one another? And that took about 15 to 20 years to figure out that yes, psychology and Christianity can talk and dialogue. And then there's a couple models that came out of that. One was much more integrative in attempting to feed into a mutual dialogue about Christianity and faith. Other models were much more a separate sort of seeing faith on one level and then seeing psychology on another level and sort of having two separate kinds of discourses. Since that time, there has been other models developed. Some have faith as more ascendant in its determination of what's how you lead in the clinical encounter, and others are much more attempt to bring together both worlds of knowledge, both the world of say psychology or psychoanalysis and faith. And so, what we're trying to do here, and I think Brad is right. What we're trying to do is to come from a very experienced near encounter in the clinical work. So what really matters in the interaction between the patient and the therapist? And part of what we're getting at is that you cannot get away from a value-saturated conversation. And it's not explicit, like, I believe this or you believe that. But certainly when we're talking about the directions of people's lives or meanings in people's lives, then we're talking about values and we're talking about sort of a moral discourse, which then highlights the importance of understanding where people come from. And I think that's back to Brad's point about being able to tradition ourselves, and you can't reduce that to just sort of side thing. Well, I'm Christian or I'm Presbyterian or I'm Catholic or what have you, that actually has significant effect on how we understand the clinical enterprise, how we understand ourselves, how we understand models of health, even models of communication.
Absolutely. So in continuing on this same path, I thought that it might be helpful to address some of the arguments that you make in order to introduce this conversation, which really is throughout the book. I mean, you try to select a pretty diverse group of theoretical backgrounds. All of them do have a relational basis, as you said, and I think that was your goal to kind of point to what it is that offers in this conversation. Mm-hmm. But in the first chapter, you dig pretty deep in discussing why this is relevant, in particular, introduce this concept of emergence, as well as systemic causation. Mm-hmm. Too much to ask you guys to discuss that a little bit, and kind of introduce the audience to that argument within the book?
Go for it, Earl.
Yeah. So part of the way that we let me just give some background in sort of what the first chapter is attempting to do is if we're going to have a discussion between faith and psychoanalysis in the clinical encounter, then we have to have some way of understanding the way knowledge works and the way interactions work. And so the terms that we use, such as, let's say from a psychoanalytic perspective, such as ego or self or, object, those kind of object representation and so on and so forth, those have specific meaning within a community. When we go to the faith side, things such as God or transcendence or prayer or the way that we might understand God to work in one's experience, that also has to make sense. And so we think, I'm fairly sure that most of the audience that would listen to this is familiar with nonlinear dynamic systems and the way in which both within development and with the ongoing maintenance of our relational experience is that there are mutually influencing factors both from a developmental place and also from the context in which that development occurs that are always at play within the interaction and in the clinical situation. So we tried to pull out of some of that kind of a sort of intersubjective non-linear dynamic systems perspective clinically, but as well as taking a look at how do we think about the possibility of something emerging out of the clinical encounter that wasn't there before. And so essentially, emergence comes out of science and is an attempt to explain causation. And how do you have a non-material kinds of things that come out of material processes? So if we think about the concept of a self, we can think about that as being the result of sort of different aspects of brain functioning that emerge together that allow us to experience the notion of self. So, and when that occurs, it's sort of, we experience ourselves as whole and an I, an ongoing sense of I. And so we think about the clinical encounter as also having those kinds of emergent properties. Now, I will have, in terms of its outcome, sort of, things will emerge out of the clinical process that we didn't plan on and that weren't there before. Now, one of the things we do play with in the first chapter is the notion of emergence within theology. And I'm going to just pause this for those who aren't familiar with that concept within theology. It's more controversial. And so what we're trying to do is to make a little bit of a, sort of a suggestion that maybe one of the ways that we can think about faith and to think about the way that it moves in psychology is that God is present within the very processes of the psychotherapeutic enterprise. So if you conceptualize God as a relational being, and then you conceptualize psychotherapy or psychoanalysis as a relational encounter, then one of the things that you're looking for, I think, and from my perspective, certainly can count on, is what we call an immanental presence of God in that relational exchange. And those of us who sort of think that way really look for how the relational experience can highlight experiences of the divine. So I think that when I am in a psychoanalytic encounter, it's not just thinking about it as two human subjects, but also thinking about it as a relational encounter that echoes the sort of God's design for how he works in the world, which is through relationship. Let me stop there, and Brad, I don't know if you want to fill in some of the stuff that I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I think you've said it really well. I think I probably would just summarize in my own words. I think that emergence is a way to talk about the reality of a material world in a non-reductive way.
Mm-hmm.
So that too often religion has been seen as something that is outside of human experience, and so therefore it has a kind of defensive understanding, you know, beginning with Freud. And so to talk about human persons and experience and life as being material and physical is sometimes been difficult for religious people. But I think emergence allows us to talk about life that way and yet also recognize, again, as Earl said, through this complex non-linear dynamic systems, that from the complexity of the brain or what it means to be a body or bodies embedded within complex communities all the way from ant colonies to cities, that things emerge from that, things such as mind. In the analytic literature, sometimes when people write about the third, mm-hmm. we can talk about it as something emerges from the unique intersubjective experience of two people. And I think partly what we want to say, too, is that spirituality emerges from material as well. But none of these things can be completely reduced to a kind of physicalist only approach, because it's not that simple. You can't locate the mind or third or spirituality in atoms and molecules. It comes about through this really complex, exciting, ever-changing, uncontrollable chaos kind of theory experience that it is to be human beings in the world. So it's non-reductive, but again, it is material. So Earl's comment about this kind of immanental cosmology, that perhaps God is at work in the very nature of human beings and in creation, is kind of a both end. And I think that's why, you know, personally, that's why I'm attracted to more of the relational theories in psychoanalysis, because they resist reductionism. And they resist an either or kind of approach, but it's always kind of a both end. And that's where I see emergence being really helpful to us.
Absolutely. As I was reading the book, I was also thinking about how it would be processed by somebody who doesn't have a religious background or even a specifically Christian background. And I found that this idea, which you express on page 20 of the introduction, you write, as soon as we attempt to explain human functioning in psychoanalytic or theological frames, we move toward abstract, complex categories that may not link directly to physical or material substance, which is what you're saying now. The ante goes up further when we attempt to develop a meaningful conversation between these two forms of dialogue. Distinct theological and psychoanalytic explanations of human behavior and functioning can share constructive explanatory space. That concept, which you guys have explained even more clearly than was in the book for me, you've explained sort of why it makes sense for these two things to exist in the same conversation, to be thought about in the same place, in a way that has very little to do with one's personal belief on a sort of conceptual level. It makes sense when you introduce that idea.
I think that's fair, Claire. I mean, I think clearly we're coming at it from a Christian perspective, but I think that we're looking for a model to try to explain how that occurs. I certainly would think that a person from a, you know, alternative faith perspective or even sort of more of a general spiritual sensitivity may be able to think about it in those terms. What is going on in the complex nature of a discussion in which two very dynamic people who emerge out of their own context and so on and so forth have a conversation? I think you're fair. That's a fair comment.
How would you frame this work for individuals who don't have a Christian background or who don't even have a religious leaning? How would you frame this for them in their clinical work?
It's a great question. I think for me, again, a couple things we've touched on before. I think the first is a call for clinicians to recognize or at least grapple with the idea that implicit within their theory of clinical psychoanalysis, it are kind of these implicit embedded ethical systems, within our theories are statements about how one ought to live or what the good life looks like. Even if we say that human health is to be in loving relationships with one another, that still begs the question, what do those loving relationships look like? Loving relationships to what end? I think for too long, psychology in general and psychoanalysis specifically has attempted to, you know, have this kind of value neutral stance. Now, thankfully, many psychoanalytic writers well before us have challenged that. And so I think we've moved away from that in a lot of ways. But I still think that the average kind of clinician in the trenches often thinks of him or herself as value neutral, as they're not imposing, as they're not even having this moral dialogue. And so I think the first usefulness, hopefully, of the book would be for someone who's not religious to at least begin to think about that. Secondly, I'd say, is to recognize, as Randy Sorensen said in his book, Minding Spirituality, that Earl referenced, you know, many of our patients are coming to us from religious traditions. And those religious traditions function like culture in their lives. And they give people a sense of purpose and meaning and direction and a goal or a telos for their life. And so our goal is not to unthinkingly analyze those away as some sort of defense mechanism against something else, but to recognize the importance of those issues while also recognizing that they can be, in fact, analyzed and explored in terms of the meaning they make, the ways that, yes, at times they can be used defensively, but also at times the way in which they're used in healthy and adaptive ways. And so I hope for someone who's not religious, I think it could be kind of a, you know, sort of like reading a book on cross-cultural psychology, honestly, that would help sensitize the clinician to not only his or her own kind of implicit values that they're bringing into the room, but also begin to help them think about how do then I have a conversation with the person with whom spirituality or faith is very important to their sense of identity.
Yeah, I want to echo that because I think that that's a really important part of the discussion. I actually think that hopefully that this goes into a whole bunch of literature that is emerging in psychoanalysis right now about the importance of understanding issues of spirituality, faith background, values, moral discourse, all of that. And I think I'll reference back to Marie Hoffman again. I think she's actually done some pretty good work in sort of detailing the implicit religious narratives in many, many, many psychoanalytic writers. And so that those underlying kinds of things, religious narratives really didn't get to see the light of day in the predominant scientism in out of which psychoanalysis emerged. So if the whole conversation out of sort of ethos in which your particular discipline emerges does not allow for a discussion of things like faith, then those things automatically go into sort of a background kind of place. And what Brad and I are arguing is that's true. And that's historical. However, those things are always operative. And so even if we're not talking about faith issues explicitly, we believe that both the analyst and the patient have some kind of relationship with that, either internally or sort of that gets practiced off to the side. And it's just not talked about. And I would argue that even for those that don't consider themselves to be a faith tradition at all, there's still an understanding or a sort of implicit kind of knowledge that might go around issues of ultimacy in which deep sort of meaning questions related to life get answered. And those might not use the language of faith, but they have the context of what faith issues are attempting to address. And so we're trying to make the argument but let's pay attention to this. And again, this is not the first time this argument has been made. I think we try to make it a little bit more explicit. Yeah. And I think that certainly chapter two, Brad and his co-authors with that really argue that you have to understand your own background. Just like you would analyze your own personal history and understand kind of the impact of your development, Part of that analysis of your of what you're bringing to the room is your faith tradition.
Yeah, in that chapter, you introduced that, Brad, that idea as making a confession, which I thought was just, aside from it being fun, it also, it again made it really obvious what the confluence between these two systems of meaning is. You've been mentioning the interpretation that you guys make of Freud's view on religion. Would you be able to discuss that a little bit?
I'll start out, Brian. You can certainly echo. I think that the Freud, I think it's fairly evident at this point that Freud's relationship to religion was ambivalent. There's an important book that came out by, I believe it's Daniel McCurr, called Relating to God. And it actually came out in 2014 as well. But in that book, he really he goes into detail about Freud's. He spends a whole 300 pages talking about Freud's sort of back and forth with religion. I think that what we're trying to do here, and this is not the first time this argument has been made, is that there is you can read psychoanalysis as being hostile towards religion. And certainly there were aspects of religion at that time that Freud felt were defensive, and largely were, sort of influential of pathological outcomes. But I think it's also, important for us to recognize, that he also played with it in different kinds of ways and that he had a sensitivity to issues related to spirituality. And that's a complex, thing that I think McCurr brings out. But we find, and I think, even Freud himself says, is that psychoanalysis is not anti-religion in its very foundation. It is sort of a method that to help us understand possibly the way in which religion plays a role in individuals' lives. That's a whole really, I think, complex, very huge argument conversation, but I think we're trying to get at the point where if your history has said to you that Freud didn't like religion, and so therefore religious people aren't going to like Freud, we want to sort of open up that conversation to a much different level.
Well, I think one of the points that is made in the book is that the moment the concept of a Trinitarian God focuses on relationships, the idea of religion that Freud was speaking about or addressing as having a kind of paternalistic structure, it reaches a limit. So I was wondering if you'd be able to sort of frame the shift in psychology after Freud, which sort of parallels this shift in theology, which makes this conversation easier to have at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's James Jones's comment. And I think it's an important one, is that if we look at Freud's building a dynamic off of a sort of an exalted father figure, if that's the way that you think about Freud in religion, well, that makes sense maybe within more of a classical model. However, if we think about spirituality or faith in relational terms, and we also have had a relational tilt within psychoanalysis, then that's how we're talking about faith and the development of faith within a person's life, and the way in which we can think about the meaning of faith within a person, within the clinical encounter. So rather than talking about faith as defensive, right, then we can talk about or faith as having superego functions and the attempts to sort of manage certain impulses and so on and so forth. If we're looking at it from more of a relational experience, and we're thinking possibly the addition of a deficit model to this, then in what ways does relationship function within the individual's life? And then the whole notion of relationality within spirituality, as so God functioning within relationship ongoing wise, I think gets more cachet.
I don't think what we're saying is that Freud got everything wrong. We have great respect for Freud, and he got some things right. But as already mentioned, he has a very, what Neville Symington calls a very primitive understanding of religion. And so it is this relational turn in theology where we recognize a God who's both transcendent and immanent, who desires to have an ongoing relationship with God's creation. And in fact, in some ways and in some circles, we can talk about how God's creation, in fact, impacts God and moves and changes God in such a way that we, as we talk about in the first chapter, God and God's creation are in this kind of inextricable entanglement with one another, mutually influencing one another. So a lot of the conflict has been around the sort of presuppositions that each of the disciplines have made about one another, which of course becomes problematic. And then a lot of the integration conversation in the past has not been conversation. It's not been dialogue. It's really been about debate. The question ultimately is, well, who wins at the end of the day? And I think the relational turn, which again, with its understandings embedded in constructivism and narrative theology and narrative psychology, the whole powerful philosophical movement of hermeneutics and phenomenology, all of this provides an opportunity for the two disciplines to be actually in a conversation where the goal is not who wins, that's a debate, right? But a conversation in which both disciplines, and those disciplines are often epitomized by, you know, two different theorists or two different theories, or in the clinical room, two different people. When we're in a true conversation, as Gadamer says, then we are at risk to be changed. And I think, again, at a deeper sort of analytic or psychological level, one of the things that makes this difficult is that we're at risk of being changed. And that actually becomes quite uncomfortable for some of us. And so the very integrative dialogue at times breaks down, I think, not because they're intellectually incompatible, but because at some deeper level, it makes us quite frightened.
Right. So in the book, we have thinkers speaking on attachment theory, relational psychoanalysis, intersubjective systems theory, object relations, and so on. What struck me about all of these different schools of thought is that the way that they were conceptualizing the relationship between parent and child, in particular in the case of attachment theory, I think this was the most obvious. It's also obvious in object relations theory, which obviously are closely related. The way that that relationship between parent and child, and then later between spouses in a marital relationship, functions very similarly to this way that you're conceptualizing a relational God. First of all, am I reading this correctly? And second of all, was it intentional to bring together a group of people who at least were speaking from traditions that could illuminate aspects of that relationship?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think one of the first things we wanted to try to do is to, as Earl said, in one way, our audience are people of faith who are dabbling in psychoanalysis or interested in it, but maybe have been frightened away because they were told, you know, in their introductory textbooks that it's dead. We know obviously that psychoanalysis is not dead. But we wanted to clarify that in part by suggesting that even within psychoanalysis, there are a number of different schools, right? And there's other schools that we could have had other chapters from other schools as well. So we wanted to clarify that. As we mentioned before, we wanted to give each author the opportunity to demonstrate their theory in conversation with their own particular religious tradition and apply that to a case. There's a case that runs through each one of the chapters, the same case, to kind of help the reader compare and contrast. I don't know that we went in trying to make the point that, maybe Earl, you'll say something different, but I don't think we went in trying to make the point that our human relationships simply mimic the relationship with the divine or vice versa. I think we see some of that, and obviously there's some literature, even empirical literature in the attachment world that demonstrates some of that. I think we also want to recognize, you know, we recognize and begin with that God is a being, and that this being, therefore, is not limited, again, not reduced to psychology. So one of the things I think we wouldn't be comfortable with is reducing the human to the divine relationship, we would not want to reduce that to some sort of object relational history. We want to hold open that God is a being who can interact in the ways in which God wants to that are consistent with God's very nature, obviously. So God's not going to act in a way that's outside of God's nature. But what we do see is a lot of parallels, a lot of similarities, and a lot of sort of, you know, we can talk about it as transference or projection or internal working models. And in fact, early object relational history does have a bearing on an impact with how one interacts with the divine. And yet there's plenty of stories, you know, case studies in the literature, and even I think in some of the empirical work that suggests that people with, you know, very disturbed attachment styles somehow can find a way to have a quite positive relationship with God. There may be intervening relational experiences that we can't necessarily measure or know about. Or in fact, it may be, again, that a God who can interact in the way in which God wants to can have a direct relationship with human beings. So I'm not quite sure if that's getting at your question, Claire, but I did want to clarify, I think, that we don't want to reduce human-divine relationship to simply human-to-human relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely it does. I think what I meant by that is that when you have an object relations theorist talking about object relations in the same context of a conversation about one's personal relationship to God, you can kind of see how I'm not saying that the dynamics are identical, that the dynamics are mirroring one another, but there is a way in which the language isn't foreign. Maybe you can challenge that reading, but that it's possible to understand a client or a Nalasan's relationship to their God in similar terms in a treatment setting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Very much so. I think that's very true. And I think some authors have also written about the reverse of that, of analyzing one's relationship with God as a kind of template for in the other direction. But yeah, I don't think you're wrong in saying that at all. I'm sorry, you're like cut you off.
No. I'm echoing that. I think that partially what you also may find, Claire, in reading the book is that the authors have sort of sunk themselves into the theory. And so there really is an intimate dialogue between the theory and one's understanding of faith. And again, I not to reify concepts, but I do think that maybe to the degree that that we are drawn to certain types of theoretical explanations, that those are in conversation with our own faith background and the degree and the way in which we understand our relationship with God. Yeah. So there's a sort of a co-construction going on there. And I think we were trying to find theorists who were deeply committed to their faith and then help them to understand psychoanalytic theory in a conversation with that faith.
Yeah. I noticed just through reading each of the chapters, theoretical or clinical confluence. One of the things that I want to address is the idea that there's like a redemptive quality to psychoanalytic psychotherapies. That was one thread that I found throughout. But just in reading it, the authors seem to feel so refreshed by the invitation to discuss this. And I think Teresa Tisdale, I believe, devotes a significant amount of time to kind of making that statement. I think the result is immense clarity. All of these disciplines are very jargon heavy, but there was immense clarity in just reading in reading the perspective. Am I getting somewhere around the mark in saying that there is an agreement among many of the authors, maybe yourselves as well, that there is a redemptive quality to the treatment settings?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think we say in chapter one that, you know, from sort of in theological language, we could understand the very practice of psychoanalysis as a kind of sanctifying methodology, meaning that it's redemptive. It's also, again, in the theological language, it's working on the very character of a person, and for a person of faith, Christian faith, that character might be towards likeness of Christ, for example. that one could love more and love differently, love one's enemies, care for the poor, care for the widows and the orphans. Those sorts of, again, those, what I described as sort of, you know, issues of ultimacy. You know, why am I really here? What am I really up to? Obviously, some psychotherapies, even psychoanalysis, begins with, you know, I've got this problem. I have the symptoms, if you will. But psychoanalysis is, I think, always understood those symptoms as representative of kind of larger questions of meaning and ultimacy. And so, again, when that happens, you're into this very deep waters of ethics and meaning and theology and purpose. And so as we're working with someone psychoanalytically, there's something quite redemptive. There's like a new birth. There's like and people will say this, even non-religious people, I feel like I grew up in analysis. I feel like I became a person. I feel like I became human. There's all these kinds of wonderful metaphors of rejuvenation and rebirth and redemption.
Right. So speaking to that point, to what extent can this insight be applied to situations where, you know, in your case, you have a Christian background, and this is the way that you're framing your understanding. Perhaps your client does not. How do you kind of like modulate that and accommodate for that? When does this become invoked? Under what circumstances does it need to be pulled back from, or is it possible to apply it in a way that's not imposing, I guess?
Cool. Yeah, I think Claire, that one of the important things we're trying to do in the book is to answer sort of this question. I think that many Christians come into the field when they come into psychology, and many non-Christians or people of non-faith, is that do we have to be explicit in the use of language, or explicit in our use of concepts, if we're going to have redemptive processes or Christian processes or moral conversations? And I think that what we're trying to argue is that, well, yeah, sure, but not necessarily. And that I think the Christian understanding of redemption, the notion of turning, being different, and finding new life, I think that those are concepts that do not need explicit language attached to them. So I think Brad is right. Certainly, their faith can enter into the conversation and analysis in any number of ways. But I think what we're trying to say is that even if it doesn't, and even if the clinician and the analyst and the analysand are of different traditions, that there can be a deeply redemptive process in the relational exchange, in the relational connection, that echoes very clearly with the Christian ethic. And not just Christian ethics, but other faith ethics as well. And that can be truly transformative. And so I think, Brad, if I'm, you may want to jump in and clarify a little bit, but I think that really is part of the thing that we want to echo deep in this book, is that relationship has, meaning, whether you use explicit language or whether the people come from the same tradition or not. Is that correct, Brad?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think it's not a call for a kind of Christian psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. In other words, an imposition. You know, we try to stay away from this is how one ought to practice it. It's again, it's not model-based. It's much more procedural, I would say. But I think the other thing that we do recognize, again, And this work, again, is not coming out of religious circles, but it's coming out of, you know, psychoanalysis itself, with the, you know, the work of people like Erwin Hoffman and Owen Renick and Lou Aaron. The analyst's irreducible subjectivity has to be dealt with, and it has to be used therapeutically. And so partly what we're saying is one's tradition, one's faith tradition or spiritual commitments or even ethical commitments are a kind of tradition. These are part of the analyst's irreducible subjectivity. And so we're interested in the relational turn in psychoanalysis because there's wonderful literature now on how and when should we use that subjectivity, whether it's about sexuality or about the use of money or about faith. So I'm totally in agreement with Earl that there's something redemptive about this work, whether faith is ever explicitly talked about. But I think there's also the next phase of this is the question that we get a lot is, okay, well, when and how do we talk about it? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is sort of, again, another relational answer, which is, well, it depends.
Thank you.
That's funny. So how does this, and this will be my last question before we close out, but how would you situate this book and the questions that it deals with and tries to reconcile within the context of the professional organization that you guys are a part of and what you're trying to do there?
Are you talking about our broad analytic professional or our schools or
your schools, yeah.
Well, yeah, so both of us, I'm at Rosemead School of Psychology at Biola University, and Brad's at Fuller Theological Seminary. And so here, I know at least at Rosemead here, we have a long tradition of analytic theory being sort of holding an important place in orienting how we approach clinical training. So for me, in my professional work, this is a certainly fits right in with the direction of the program in general. So I see it as very congruent with how I work and the training that I do.
Right.
Yeah, and obviously very true for myself as well. If I could just expand the question a little bit, I mean, I would love to say that, you know, Earl and I are following, again, a tradition of many great mm-hmm. analytic writers who have had interest in faith, including Meisner and Rizzuto, mm-hmm. And, you know, again, currently, more currently, Marie Hoffman, and a number of, Lou Aaron, looking at Judaism in various ways. So I feel like, you know, it's in this conversation of the larger integration of faith and psychology, but I hope that it's a natural continuation of a conversation in psychoanalysis and religious tradition as well.
And do you see that conversation as expanding more broadly into other aspects of the psychoanalytic community, or is that like a place that this hasn't evolved to yet, I guess,
No, I think it's expanding. I mean, the organization I mentioned earlier, the Society for the Exploration of Psychoanalytic Therapies and Theology, has a listserv of, I don't know what it is now, Earl, close to 500 or something, 300,
500.
Yeah. And many of these people would be sort of, kind of religiously interested or religiously curious, opposed to, I'm of this faith tradition. So I think that's happening. I think we're seeing more books, even in the analytic literature, being published that have to do with faith in some way. There's a lot of work in Buddhism, in the last 10 years in psychoanalysis, Catholicism in psychoanalysis. So I think that, I think it really is a movement. One of our close friends, Paula Hamm, also runs a study group, through the American Psychoanalytic Association that meets every year, which is on spirituality and psychoanalysis. So these dialogues have been going on for some time. I just think maybe because of some of the prejudice and some of the historical baggage, they don't get quite the press that other things do.
Well, thank you so much for involving me in the conversation. I've learned a lot, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you both.
Thanks, Blair.
Thank you, Blair.